and follow the very basic instructions, then basically you're there. You've done the practice. So very one of the great things about Buddhism, if you hear the same instructions again and again, many, many times, after a while it starts to sink in and you understand what you have to do. Because meditation is actually something which is extraordinarily basic and simple. There's nothing complicated about it whatsoever. And it's a fact, it is the simplicity of meditation which makes it so difficult. Because we tend to complicate things. We're not able to actually live with things which are really, really simple. Because meditation is really the art of doing absolutely nothing here. We're not used to doing absolutely nothing. We can't do absolutely nothing here. We're always doers. We're compulsive doers. We do this, we do that. We think about this, we run around. In our society, we are not used to doing absolutely nothing here. What they say about, one of the reasons they say is why they had such good meditators in the northeast of Thailand, you know, where Ajahn Chah was from, where many of the great meditation masters were from. The reason they were so good is because they had a very simple life. And very often they would just sit out in the rice paddies and watch the buffaloes wandering around and doing absolutely nothing. So they had very peaceful minds. But in our modern society, when everything is like a rush, we're rushing around, doing way, way too many things in our lives, it becomes very complicated. And we can't just be still and just be quiet. And that's why meditation becomes difficult. Not because it is difficult, because we just can't let go. We just can't relax. Recently, there was one of the Anagarikas, one of the 8 preceptors in our monastery in Bodhinyana in Perth. He said to me that now, finally, after 3 years, I've understood the instruction for meditation. And that was, you can imagine, every week Ajahn Brahm gives a talk, every week he would read this book and he would read that book, and they would get instructions left, right and center. And yet after 3 years, he reckoned, now I've understood the instruction. What is the instruction? Do nothing here. It takes a long time to understand, do nothing here. And that's the problem. And of course, the reality is that he hasn't still really hasn't understood that instruction. He has understood the instruction partially, and he thinks he knows what it's all about. But in 2 years' time, he's going to come back and say, now I really have understood this instruction. And so it goes on and on for years and years until eventually you're able to sit down and just let go and allow things to be. So because the instruction is actually so hard for us to understand, it is so hard for us to understand because it goes against the grain, it goes against the way that we normally live our lives. You need some kind of guidance for you to decide what is it that actually is a good meditation. How do you know whether you're doing the right thing in your meditation practice? And the answer to that is that if you are increasing in good states, if you are finding some kind of peace, if you're finding some kind of joy in your meditation, if you feel a sense of compassion or metta in your heart, whenever these good qualities are arising inside of you, then you know that the meditation is going in the right direction. So it's always about monitoring yourself. Look at what is happening inside of you. And if good states are increasing, if you're feeling better, if you're feeling more at ease, if you're feeling more relaxed, if you're feeling good about yourself, then you know that you're doing the right thing here. If on the contrary, you feel tense and you feel kind of uptight and you feel ill will even because of the meditation practice, well, then you're probably not doing the right thing here. So keep that in mind, because many people spend a lot of time doing stupid things which actually leads in the wrong direction. This is so important. So monitor yourself. Look inside of yourself. Is it working? Is it not working? What is happening here? And the purpose of meditation practice, particularly in lay life, in your daily life, should be, in my opinion, to support your other practices as a Buddhist. In ordinary lay life, you cannot expect to get very profound meditation. You're not going to get the jhanas. You're not going to get all these beautiful nimittas. You're not even going to get lots of joy very often. But use it, in a sense, to support your practice in ordinary daily life. And what does that mean? It means that, of course, what we want to do as Buddhists, we want to be kind, we want to be good-hearted, we want to treat other people with right speech, right action, even right thought. Now, to be able to do that successfully, what you have to do is you have to purify your mind. Put your mind in such a position that right action, right speech, and right thinking happens almost as a matter of course. In the long run, that's the only way you're going to succeed in being kind, being good, is if your mind is in the right place. If your mind is in the wrong place, it means that you always have to watch yourself. You always have to be careful so you don't actually say the wrong thing because your mind is negative or whatever. But if your mind is in the right place, it happens all by itself. So use your meditation in such a way that you strengthen those qualities inside of you that give rise to good virtue and good morality and good conduct. This is, I think, the most important aspect of meditation in lay life. And then when you go on the retreat, when you come to our Jhana Grow Retreat Center in Perth, or you go to retreat in Singapore or Malaysia, whatever it is, then you have the chance to try to go for deeper meditation states. Then is what really is the right time to go for those kind of things. So make sure that this is what the meditation does for you. It supports your practice as a Buddhist. If it does that, then it is going to be very useful and very beneficial for you. So just before we start the meditation, I'm going to give you some guidelines on how to look upon meditation, to give you some sense of what kind of mind state, how you can set up your mind in the right way before you start your meditation. Now, one very useful way of looking at meditation practice is to remember that it is a middle path. It's all about middle path. This is Buddhism, right? The middle path, the Noble Eightfold Path. Now, the middle path in meditation is just like the middle path, the Noble Eightfold Path. You try not to get into self-mortification where you have lots of pain in the body and you get all kinds of trouble. You feel ill at ease. You don't relax and all these kind of things. Steer away from that. That is the wrong end of the path. It's called self-mortification where you're actually having too much pain. You're not enjoying yourself. If you have pain, use a chair in the back. Sit in a different position. Get an extra cushion. Do whatever you need to feel at ease, relaxed. Otherwise, it's difficult enough to meditate as it is, unless you're also going to add all kind of pain and all kind of discomfort as well. So that is the one side. Now the other side is called indulgence. This is the Kama Sukhali Kanu Yoga on the middle way. This is going to the other side. Now that other side means that you are indulging. For example, if you're lying down on your back and you're so comfortable that you fall asleep straight away, or you just really, this is so nice, this is so wonderful, you can see that the mind goes towards indulgence because you are actually enjoying the comfort of the situation or whatever it is. Now that is the other thing that you want to avoid. So you want to avoid the indulgence, and you also want to avoid the pain and the self-mortification, if you like. And the beautiful thing there is the middle way which goes between those two. Now, why does that work? Why is it that there is a middle way between those two things? And the answer is that when the body hurts, the body is important. When the body hurts, you will think about the body. And you will think, what can I do to alleviate the pain? What can I do to get rid of this terrible thing in the body? So when you have pain, when you have discomfort, the body is important. Now, if you indulge the body, again, the body is important because now you're getting pleasure out of the body. Because you're getting pleasure out of the body is important again. So in both these extremes, the body is important. And because the body is important, the mind goes to the body, either to find pleasure or to avoid the pain. You see what I mean? These two extremes are body-focused, and that's why they don't work. But if instead you go that middle way, you don't have any pain, you don't have any pleasure, then the body tends to vanish because the body is not important anymore. When the body has no pain, no pleasure, it's just a neutral feeling, it's irrelevant. It doesn't matter. And that, when the body vanishes, that is where you can actually find that sense of ease and relaxedness in the mind. And the mind can become peaceful, and you can just go inwards into yourself. And the body is completely irrelevant. So that is why this is the middle path in terms of Buddhism. The body had to be at ease, but not indulged. Now, if I like to say that if sometimes it's hard to find that middle way, you don't know exactly where it is. If you're going to go wrong slightly on the side of indulging, because pain is always terrible. It's always something, you know, you really want to avoid pain, because otherwise you're going to be discouraged from meditating in the long run. You're going to feel, oh, I don't want to do this. I'm going to become a Christian instead, or whatever. And we don't want that. That is terrible. I wouldn't want to encourage anybody to become Christian rather than Buddhist. So find that if you're going to indulge, if you're going to go slightly wrong on one side, go wrong on the side of indulgence. Have an extra cup of tea, have an extra cushion or whatever. So make sure that you look after yourself and you feel good about yourself. It also makes you feel good when you feel that you're looking after yourself. When you feel that you're looking after yourself, you feel good about yourself, because this is one of the kind of the basic things in human beings. We want to look after ourselves. If we are hard on ourselves, then we don't feel so good about ourselves. So try to remember that middle way. This is one of these tricks in meditation that can help you to get the meditation to take off. Now, another trick that I want to talk about today, and this is to remember the Buddhist teaching of non-self. This is a very profound teaching, and if you can use this in a meditation practice, it can be very useful. What does non-self mean in terms of meditation? What it means is that we cannot control the meditation. We're not in charge. The meditation cannot be made to go this way. It cannot be made to go that way. We cannot force the hindrances away. We cannot force peace to arise in the mind. Sometimes we try to use force to make peace in the mind. Sometimes we try to make force to arouse the feeling of loving kindness. But remember that these things cannot be controlled. Why? Because from a Buddhist point of view, there is nothing in here. There's no self which actually can direct these things and force these things to come up or disappear or whatever it might be. So because it is impossible to direct things, the only answer then is to let things go instead, to relax, to sit back and allow things to be. So to get peace then, there is another way of looking at how to get peace. And that is to understand that peace arises due to causes and conditions. There are natural causes which give rise to peace, and there are natural causes which give rise to restlessness and lack of peace. And once you understand the natural causes, then you allow those natural causes to arise. You focus on nature, you focus on how the mind works, on the mechanics of the mind, the mechanics of the situation, and then you can allow it to arise. So you don't do anything with willpower, you don't force things, but you understand the nature of peace. What is the nature of peace? The nature of peace is that if you withdraw the will, if you withdraw the doer inside, the thing which controls, then peace comes all by itself. It arises in the mind on its own accord. That is the nature of peace. That is the nature of the mind. So all you have to do is basically wait. You have to be patient. You have to just sit there and allow things to be. And then it is the nature of the mind to calm down. So remember what the nature of the mind is. And that is how you can slowly find peace. No self. You cannot control these things. Because you can't control them, there's no point in trying to control them. Instead, remember what the nature is and the cause and conditions that give rise to peace. This is a very important and useful instruction, I think. Yeah. Yeah, and another way, another important thing to remember also as you practice this path is to know yourself, know your abilities, understand your mind, understand your defilements, your strengths and weaknesses. And the more you understand yourself, the more you understand what you need to do for your meditation to take off. For example, there will be days when you perhaps feel very restless, the mind is running around, you feel ill at ease, nothing is really working out. And sometimes you try to sit in meditation for 5 minutes, and you know straight away, this is not going to work. Today is not the right day. So instead of torturing yourself, go up, do something else, do something nice, go for a walk, say something nice to your husband or to your wife or to your kids, and try to sort of, you know, get something going. Listen to some nice piece of music which calms you down and makes you feel peaceful. And then when you start to find that peace in another way, then you can try again to sit down in meditation. This is about self-knowledge. Know when the right time is to meditate. Know when it is the wrong time. Have some insight into your own mind. Also understand what kind of temperament you have. What is your character type? There are some people who are more prone to negativity and anger than others. And if you are the kind of person who is prone to negativity and anger, then try to make sure that you deal with that aspect of the mind. Deal with the negativity. Try to get used to doing some loving kindness meditation where you try to change the nature of your mind. Because anger and negativity is one of the great hindrances for peace. If you have that in your mind, you're going to feel negative, you're not going to be happy, and there's no way that you're going to find peace. Instead, what you're going to find very often is sloth and torpor, and you're going to fall asleep. Generally speaking, I would recommend everybody to do loving kindness meditation. It's one of those very universally powerful meditation techniques. And I would recommend every single person here to do this because it is incredibly supportive for living a good life. And not only is it supportive for living a good life, it's supportive for feeling good about yourself, it's supportive for feeling at ease, it's supportive for meditation. If you can have a sense of loving kindness, the mind becomes concentrated and you find samadhi and stillness coming so much more easy to you if you have that sense of loving kindness. And I will just give you some very brief instructions on how to practice loving kindness in your life. Now, one of the very important things with loving kindness meditation is that if you have a sense of anger or negativity against anybody in particular, that is where you need to work. Because that negativity that you have to somebody else is going to tend to poison your mind, and you're going to take that very often into your meditation practice. So very often what you have to do, where you have to start off, is to learn to let go of that anger or negativity towards those particular individuals. And this is often things that you can do in daily life. Learn to look at things differently, learn to perceive things differently, try to understand the person, where they're coming from, try to understand why they are difficult in your life, what it is that makes this person difficult. And you can, in this way, by being wise about this other person, you can change your perception of them. Very often you may not be able to love them, and that's not really the point, but very often you can come to accept them for what they are. Life is always, there is no two people on this planet who see things in exactly the same way. And because of that, there's always going to be disagreements, there's always going to be different ways of looking at things, there's always going to be difficult people in life. And when you understand that there's always going to be difficult people in life, then eventually the penny drops and you say, okay, I just got to accept this as it is. And you know that the reason why people are difficult is not because they want to be difficult. People are often difficult against their desires. They want to be nice because people understand that being kind is equivalent to happiness in life. They know that being nasty or being bad is not happiness. So because of that, when you see somebody who does things that are not nice, not kind, you know that it's coming from suffering most of the time. They are suffering. Bullies are sufferers in the world. And when you understand that the other person is suffering, and you understand that this is their problem, then you can have a sense of compassion instead. Another thing, which I was just telling another person here today as well, is that when there is a problem with somebody else, remember that it's never a personal thing. It's not you against them. It's not you as a person that they're after. It's not they as a person who is bad. It's just conditions coming together. They are in such a state that when they meet a certain character trait that you happen to have in you right now, they do things which are stupid. If there had been another person there with exactly the same character traits, they would have treated the other person in exactly the same way. So it's never personal between people. It's never that person is bad or this person is nice. It's always just causes and conditions. It's your character which happens to be in a certain way, their character in a certain way, and that causes a friction. But then a few weeks later your characters have changed and the friction is gone, and another person has the problem instead. So remember this, because when you take out the fact that the personality is involved, when you take out the idea that it's me against them, that there is a sense of me being slighted or me being wronged, take out the person, it takes away 95% of the hurt. Very often it's the sense of me, it's the I inside which is the problem. Take away the I, take away that, understand that it's got nothing to do with that. It becomes so much easier. So these are some of the very, very important preliminary steps in metta meditation and compassion meditation to clear your mind of all the negativity, clear your mind of the interpersonal problems. This is so important. You can't overemphasize these things. You have to change your perception, change the way you look at people, the way you understand the world, and then gradually you will be able to do the metta meditation. Now when you do the metta meditation, remember that it's all about giving rise to a beautiful feeling inside of you. A beautiful feeling of wishing other people well. And you really have to mean this. Remember that. It's not just about sitting there saying, may all beings be well. It's actually meaning, may all beings be well. You really want to come from your heart. That is when it becomes beautiful. You actually are wishing other people well. So to make that possible, of course, the standard way in metta meditation is any object, any person, it doesn't have to be a person, it can be just like a direction in space to the east or whatever, it can be an imaginary person, any object through which you're able to give rise to that good feeling is the right object for you. And not only that, I would suggest to you to always take into account all the people here in the BF and bring them in to your metta meditation. And why is that? First of all, it is great because the people in the BF are, generally speaking, very good people. Here are people who keep the five precepts, people who try to do good things in the world, people who try to be compassionate and kind. It's quite easy to turn, you don't have to turn your mind to anybody specific, but just the idea that here are people who are good people, who are trying to do something wonderful in the world, and that just trying, just having the intention, is worthy of so much praise and so much respect from all the rest of us. So it's an easy group to have metta towards. So remember always your fellow members of the Buddhist Fellowship, always bring those in to your metta meditation, because it is an easy and good group. And the added benefit of that, as if you have metta towards each other, you will have so much more harmony and well-wishing within the Buddhist Fellowship. Often in any kind of community or group together, there's always bound to be friction. That's just the nature again of humanity. So the more you can develop that sense of understanding and seeing the good in your fellows here, the more harmony and the more beautiful group and organization you're going to have called the Buddhist Fellowship. So this is a very valuable and very useful thing to do. So try that. So try the metta meditation and try the absolutely non-doing meditation. Don't make yourself not doing. That's really what happens. You try to force yourself not to do, and there you are on the wrong track again. But just look at your mind and see what happens. If you feel relaxed, if you feel at ease, great. If you fall asleep while doing nothing at all, it's a good sign. It's a good sign you're falling asleep, because somebody falls asleep is somebody who's relaxed. Somebody who's very tense, sitting very straight, that's not so good. It reminds me, actually, I should just tell this story, because this is a very good story. It's from the suttas. I always like to quote the suttas. And this is a story which you may have heard before, but it's in the Anguttara Nikaya and occurs at least a couple of places. And this is a story of the Buddha wandering around, and he wanders around and he sees monks in different places. And he sees this one monk who's sitting next to the village, very close to the village. And this monk is sitting very straight in samadhi with his eye closed, looking very impressive. And the Buddha says, I'm not happy with that monk. And this is a very powerful teaching, because what it means is that the reason he's not happy with this monk is because he's sitting too close to the village. It's too easy to get disturbed. It's too easy for somebody to come and say, oh, venerable, I got something I want to talk to you about or whatever. So the Buddha is not happy about that. But then the Buddha goes into the forest. And the forest sees another monk, and this monk is nodding away, completely tired, doesn't look as if he has his meditation together at all. And the Buddha says, I'm pleased with that monk. It's a very powerful teaching, because what the Buddha says next is, the reason I'm pleased with this monk, he won't get disturbed, and eventually he will get over his tiredness, and then his meditation will take off. And it's the same with you here. Eventually, if you feel tired, allow that tiredness to be, allow yourself to nod or whatever, don't be proud, don't have a big ego where you feel like everybody else is looking at me so I can't nod. It's okay. It's not a competition. It's not about me being better than you or you being better than me. It's you trying to purify yourself. It's all about yourself, this meditation practice. At this point, it's about yourself. Later on, when you come out of meditation, it's also about other people, about compassion. But now, it's about purifying yourself. There's no competition there. Competition is going to detract from the meditation process. Don't worry about what other people think. Don't worry about what other people say. Just look after yourself and your own meditation. In that way, you're looking after not only yourself, but also after other people. Okay, so I think that's enough for now. So let's do some meditation together here. Okay, so just relax and find a nice comfortable position for yourself. We're going to be sitting for maybe about half an hour or so. Close your eyes, and always in meditation, always start off by feeling your body. What does it feel like? If you have any pains or aches, it's a good opportunity to move your position a little bit, to loosen up any tight belts or whatever it might be. And then after that, just feel your body. And the first thing to look out for is, do you have any tensions anywhere in your body? And the areas where people usually have tensions, the first area is, of course, the stomach region. So if you feel any kind of tension in the stomach region, just allow yourself to take a few deep breaths. Breathe in, and just as you breathe out, allow all the tension to dissipate and disappear. And also feel your shoulder region, another area where people often find tension. So imagine yourself breathing in through your shoulders. And then as you breathe out, relax all the muscles in the shoulder areas there.
And also feel your face. The face is also a place where people often have tensions. And again, if you feel any kind of tension, imagine yourself breathing in through that facial muscle. And as you breathe out, allow it all to dissipate and disappear, relaxing, nice and easy. If you feel any tension at any time during the meditation, just go back to the same procedure again and allow that tension to disappear before you continue whatever else you're doing. Allow things to disappear. Breathe in and relax. When the body feels nice and relaxed, just feel that sense of ease, a sense of comfort which is so pleasant when the body is nice and relaxed. No tensions, no problems anywhere, just a sense of nice sense of ease. Feel that, enjoy that for a few minutes. Just notice the ease in the body and realize that the ease comes about because you are withdrawing the will, you're withdrawing the volition, the pushing the body around, you're just allowing the body to be here. And that's why it feels at ease. So the more you can do that, allow the body to be here, the more at ease you will feel. Nice and easy, comfortable, feeling good. This is a very important part of getting started here. As you find that ease in the body, you also want to find the ease in the mind. And the principle is exactly the same. The ease comes when you withdraw the will, the volition, the pushing around. When you withdraw that, then the mind finds ease, becomes peaceful and quiet. And how do you do that? You do that by accepting things as they are. Accepting things is the exact opposite of volition, of will, of pushing things around. Acceptance means everything is okay as it is. So just allow things to be here. Whatever arises, allow it to be here. Just watch it. And as you do this, you will find that gradually you become more and more peaceful. Don't worry about anything. Yeah. Don't worry about the noise outside. The noise outside has got nothing to do with you. It's just there. Don't worry about anything happening inside of you. If you are dull, if you are thinking, all of these are just things arising, passing away. It's got nothing to do with you, even if it is inside of you. So allow things to be. Don't get involved. Don't control. Just accept things as they are. And allow things to calm down according to their own nature. Now I'd like you to turn your mind in a slightly different direction and to bring up the image in your mind of somebody you respect, somebody worthy of your esteem, somebody who is wise and compassionate, perhaps Ajahn Brahm or anybody else for that matter. And just remind yourself for a few minutes of all the good qualities in that person, of the peace, the compassion, the kindness, all the good qualities. And bring up those up into your mind and see a beautiful picture of that person in your mind, smiling, happy, where you can see all those qualities in their face. wish this person well. May you be happy. May you be free of suffering. May you obtain the highest peace and contentment in this world. Sometimes even the people who are very developed on the path, even they experience suffering. So may you be free of all these problems that the world always throws up. Allow it to come from your heart. Really mean it. Really desire the happiness of this other person, the freedom of from suffering. Really allow it to come from deep inside of you. Don't be superficial. Allow it to be the real thing. And now turn your attention to all the people in this room, all your fellow Buddhist Fellowship members. And again, remind yourself first of all that these people in this room are good people. People who are trying hard, people who are trying to practice a spiritual life, keeping precepts, being compassionate, people who are outstanding in this world. It's a wonderful group of people that you're together with. And when you allow that to rise in your mind, then wish them all well. May you be happy. May you be free of suffering. May you find peace and contentment in your life. wishing to go outside of this building, into the streets around here, into the nearest houses. Imagine all the people out there running around, everybody seeking for happiness, everybody trying to find an end of all the problems and sufferings in life. May all those people out there seeking for happiness, may they find that happiness. May they find less suffering in their lives. May they find peace and contentment. Just allow your well-wishing and your kindness to continue going out and out and out until eventually you encompass all of Singapore with your well-wishing. All the people out there, even all the animals that are out there. Remind yourself, all these animals are so vulnerable to suffering in their lives. There's very little they can do. May they too eventually find happiness and contentment and freedom from suffering. Very last thing to do in your meditation is to bring the same loving kindness, the same well-wishing back to yourself. You also, everyone in this room, also deserves that loving kindness and compassion. May I too be free of suffering. May I too find true peace and happiness in this life. I'm worthy of this. I may not be perfect. My intentions are good. I'm trying my best. May I find all those good things that are promised by the Buddhist path. So that's the end of the meditation. So please come out and sit comfortably again. Okay, everybody. So, would anybody like to ask any questions now, or to anything you want to comment on, maybe about meditation or anything like that, or anything else for that matter? This is the time.
Any questions?
You're asking about how to practice sati in everyday life. Okay. It's a catch-22 situation, because sati is the very act of remembering. So to remember sati is like it's a bit of a catch-22. But sati is a very difficult thing to practice fully. It's a very profound quality. And really, sati, I think the most important thing to remember on the Buddhist path is that sati is not something that you can force to arise in the mind. It's not, you cannot make a determination, I will be mindful. What you have to do is to put in to place the causes for sati to arise. That's the most important thing here. If you put in place the causes, then mindfulness will tend to be there in daily life. And those causes, the most important cause for sati is virtue, is kindness, is goodness. And the reason for that is because if you feel kind inside of yourself, if you act kindly, you have a sense of happiness inside of you. If you feel happy inside of you, you want to be in the present moment. You want to be here because you feel good. It makes sense, right? If you feel good, you want to be here. If you feel bad, you'd rather drift off into some fantasy or somewhere else because it's not nice to be in the present moment. So that this is why the purification of the mind is so important, because the more pure the mind is, the more pleasant it is to be in the present moment. I think Ajahn Brahm sometimes talks about making the present moment into the pleasant moment. One of those nice catchphrases. And that is really the answer, because the more virtuous you are, the more mindfulness arises. And of course, it takes a little bit of mindfulness to be virtuous. If you are completely lost in your thinking mind, then you tend to become angry without even noticing that anger arises. It happens so fast. So it goes together. You are virtuous, mindfulness arises. You become more mindful, you can become more virtuous. And then you can become more mindful again. It's a good cycle, things going around each other here. And it becomes a very powerful effect, cause and effect after a while. Does that make sense? Yeah. Okay, good.
Any more questions? They all are very clear.
Everybody very happy with the meditation. Everybody went really well there. Everybody. Okay, that's great. Everybody had some success. Everybody feeling more at peace afterwards. Anybody feeling worse afterwards? Anybody feel really bad afterwards? No? Okay. Okay, that's good. That's a good sign. That means you're moving in the right direction. You're feeling more peaceful. You're feeling more at ease. So that's the right way it's supposed to be. So even if you feel a bit tired or whatever, that's fine. Don't worry about that. As long as you feel more relaxed, that means you're going in the right direction. Okay, one question over there. Okay.
You said that we have to accept others for what they are. But if they are disturbing other people, don't we have to stop them?
You have to be very
careful. I think one of the, you know, one of the great dangers in life is to try to think that we're going to change other people. It's very, very difficult to change other people. I think the much more important thing to do, if somebody is disturbing somebody else and doing the wrong thing, you can, of course, you can try to say, you know, there might be a very reasonable person who can say, you know, what you're doing now is not appropriate. Maybe you can find another way. But a lot of the time, they're not going to listen because this is their conditioning, this is what they are, this is how they've been brought up, and they can't change it. It's not because they don't want to change, they literally can't change it because this is who they are, this is who they've become over a long time. So a much more important thing is to actually teach the people who are being disturbed how to be able to cope with the situation of somebody who is difficult. That is often much more useful. Because that is part of the spiritual path, you know, actually being able to accept somebody and live with somebody who is difficult. Do you understand what I'm saying? Yeah. So I think that is often more efficient, because changing people, generally speaking, is not, you can't really do that. It's difficult enough to change yourself, you know. I mean, I've been a monk now for 15 years. Sometimes I'm amazed at how stubborn this mind is, you know. You try to be nice, you try to overcome defilements, and yet they come back, you know, again and again and again. There's always endless kind of problems. And if you can't change yourself, how can you ask other people to change? It is almost, you know, it is almost unfair. First of all, we've got to work on ourselves. So if there is a problem, sometimes it's better to actually, if it cannot be worked out, it's better to try to work on the people who are being offended and say, listen, there is another way of looking at this. This person is in a difficult state. They had a difficult life, whatever. It can be expected that they're going to be a difficult person. Try to understand them. Try to have compassion. Get a bit of distance from this person. Move a little bit away so that you don't have them so close to you. So you get a bit more perspective. And this is one of the things I did myself in monastic life. Sometimes even in monastic life, you find people who are difficult. And what I would usually do is I would withdraw. And when you withdraw, you get a bit more perspective. And when you get more perspective, it's more easy to have compassion and metta and understanding for that person. So withdraw a little bit. If the person is too close to you, it's very hard to have understanding and compassion. So these are the kind of very simple tricks that you have to use. I'm not sure exactly what you're referring to, but that is roughly what I I would say here.
Maybe to build on that question, when you feel disturbed, what you just described is a certain strategy. To what extent should you allow yourself to be disturbed, or should you think about, why am I disturbed by something? Can I approach that in a different way and not feel disturbed?
Indeed. That's very much part of the deal, in a sense. If you understand that, I mean, what this is, a very large part of Buddhism is to understand what is just part of nature, and what is part of nature can't change. That is a very, very much a very, very, very important part of the Buddhist teachings. And this is also part of the idea of non-self. There's nobody in control. There's nobody who can actually control these things. It feels like we're in control, but the reality is that much less control than you think there is. But once you understand that things arise because of nature, because this is the way things are, you understand that the world is full of people who are going to be difficult. It's not necessarily that they're difficult, it's just that they don't clash with your personality, they clash with who you are or whatever it is. So once you understand that, then you can start to accept. And once you start to accept, you can actually let things go and things start to work out.
So then the act of the other person, for example, itself is not disturbing. It's purely your perception of that specific thing.
Most, 99% of the problem is your reaction to other people's acts. 1% is the other person. So if you can deal with your own reaction and your own kind of attitude towards it, basically you solve the problem. Yeah.
Ajahn Brahman, I just want to continue with the same question asked in another way. The moment you judge somebody, you're actually judging yourself, meaning that you look at somebody as obnoxious, evil. what you're actually looking at is yourself. So is that some truth in this? Just continuing from what they have, the answer you have given.
Yeah, I think when you're judging somebody else, it means that you haven't got enough compassion in your heart. You haven't got enough understanding here. And when you haven't got that, it means you're also going to judge yourself. So judging yourself and judging others is basically two sides of the same coin. You cannot judge one person without judging the other one. So yes, I would agree. It means you haven't got enough compassion in your life, enough understanding here. It's very important not to judge, because we just don't know why other people do the things they do. There's all kind of problems in life. And as soon as you become more accepting of other people, and when you make a mistake, when you become angry, when you say something you shouldn't say, you can also forgive yourself, because you realize that you are not really in control. You would like to be in control. You'd like to think that you're in charge. But again, this comes back to the whole non-self thing. You are not really in charge. The reason you get angry with yourself or upset with yourself is you feel that I should be better. I should be in charge of what I'm doing here. But you're not, and you cannot be here. And this is actually one of those profound insights. When you understand that, you can also have much more compassion on yourself. And in fact, it tends to lead to less anger. It tends to lead to better conduct, precisely because you have more understanding and more acceptance of yourself.
So with that, can I go back and tell my wife that whatever you say of me, I'm evil, I'm lousy, I'm useless, you're actually looking at yourself? Yeah.
I wouldn't recommend that. Yeah, look, try fix up yourself first, and then afterwards she might be very impressed. You know, when you get really self sorted out, she'd be so impressed. She'd do the same thing herself.
Any more questions?
No more on the same subject, different subject. I just want you to elaborate a bit on group meditation like this year, individual meditation at home, retreat meditation where you've got a good environment, then meditation where in a noisy environment and meditation in a very quiet environment. Maybe just elaborate a bit briefly on each of these, the pros and cons, and what should you do in such each of these situations.
Okay. Meditation in different circumstances, different places, and how to actually and the pros and cons, etc. Well, the greatest pro of any kind of meditation is to be far away somewhere, like living in the forest. This is the best thing you can do. And you see that in the suttas, the Buddha talks about the perception of forest as one of those kind of basic perceptions, because it is free of the noise of the city. It's free, you know, in the suttas, because it's so old, it talks about it's free of elephants and horses and all those kind of things. That's what actually made noise in those days. Today you can say it's free of cars and free of exhaust and free of, you know, tall buildings and people running here and there. And this is, for that reason, it's a very useful perception, because it takes you out of that environment which is very busy and noisy and things are happening all the time. And that's why meditation monks tend to live in the forest, because they want to get away from things. They want to get, you know, away from all this stuff. And I sometimes, when I go back to visit my parents, who live in almost the opposite side of the world, in northern Europe, I see all the stuff they've got. You know, I've got a big house, they have got this, they have got that, all this kind of things. And I live in this tiny little hut in the forest in Serpentine, Australia. And I think it's fair to say I'm far happier than my parents are. Why is that? How can that be? And the reason is because the simplicity of life, the simplicity of perception, the simplicity of everything actually is a very beautiful thing. It's something which sinks in. It makes you peaceful. It makes you happy. It makes you content. You don't have all these things to deal with. It's a great thing. So the great pro in meditation is, if you really want to get peaceful, get away. Go on a retreat. Go somewhere where it's quiet. This morning I just went for a short walk, about an hour or so, and I went down to a reserve which is just in that direction there, roughly. And just going over there, it was beautiful. This reserve was just natural forest over there. There was nobody there, absolutely quiet. So even here in the middle of Singapore, you have some beautiful spots like that. So this is one of the great pros. Get away from your ordinary life. Leave your wife behind and your kids or whatever else. Leave your apartment behind. All those things that you hold on to, that you're attached to, which bring up all this stuff in your mind. You know, the mind gets full of stuff when you see your ordinary things. Get away from that, and then you feel peaceful. Now, one of the great things about coming to a meditation group like this is that sometimes people find that the energy of group meditation is very powerful. This varies a lot from person to person. It depends on how deep your samadhi, how deep your meditation is. If you are a person who finds that deep meditation comes quite easily, which few people do, very rarely, but there are a few people who do that, you might be better for you to go completely in solitude. However, there's no fixed rule about that. Try group meditation if you find it good. And sometimes there's like an energy, there's like almost like a tangible sense of peace in the air when you sit together with a group like this. Everybody's quiet, everybody's peaceful, and there's something which pulls you along when that happens. So that is the advantage of group meditation. Of course, ideally, sometimes what you can do, if you do meditate in a peaceful place like the forest or something, and you have some success at that one, or you go on a retreat somewhere and you have some success in meditation, then later on when you go back home, you can actually bring up that perception that you had in that forest, on that retreat, bring it up in your mind, and it's like you're recreating that circumstance right there and then. So these are some of the tricks of meditation where you actually bring up these perceptions and you can actually feel peaceful even in an unpeaceful circumstance. So, yeah. Happy with that? Yeah? Okay, very good. Yeah. Okay.
Thank you, Ajahn, for the talk. You mentioned quite a few times about this concept, non-self. Could you just explain that a little bit more?
Okay. The idea of non-self is one of those very, very profound ideas in Buddhism. And basically what it means in Buddhism, that according to Buddhism, if you search inside of yourself, and you try and you look inside of yourself, all you will see is impermanent phenomena arising and passing away. That's the kind of the Buddhist idea of reality, of the world, if you like. And what it means, one of the most important consequences of that, from Buddhist point of view, is that you cannot control things. There's nobody in charge. Things are always changing. Things are moving away. And you cannot make your things be one way or make your things be another way. Let's say if your feelings really were yourself, then from a Buddhist point of view, if your feelings actually were yourself, it would mean that you could control your feelings. You could say, oh, I want to feel happy, and you will feel happy. You can't do that, right? Some days you're miserable, some days you're happy. Things go up and down. You never know. It means not being in charge. It means this is not a self. It's not something you can control. So it means, basically, what it means, ultimately, is that you have to accept a lot of things in the world for what they are. And that acceptance is a beautiful thing because it means that you can be at peace with things. You can allow things to be the way they are. So I'm just using it. I'm not trying to sort of, to kind of philosophize about the idea of non-self and teach about its profundity, because it gets very profound. I'm just trying to use a very simple idea to make your meditation more profound. Remember that you're not in charge. You cannot control these things. If you can't control them, there's only one solution. You accept them for what they are, and then they calm down according to nature. Yeah?
Ajahn, just to the question on that we cannot change things and accept things as they are, but shouldn't we try and improve situations or even improve ourselves, or should we just, accept it as it is?
There is a time to change and there is a time to accept, right? So in meditation practice, that is not the right time to sort of change yourself. That is the time to accept. Now, if in daily life, when you are interacting with people and you are doing this and that, that is the time. If you want to change yourself, that is the time to do it. So when you meet somebody and you feel bad about them, then you can think, well, is there another way of looking at this person? Is there another way of understanding this person? ask yourself, can I maybe act more kindly towards others? Can I say something nice? Can I go to my parents and tell them that I love them or that I appreciate them or whatever? All of these things are very powerful things. And small things like that, you know, you can actually, yes, improve the world. But too often we try to change the things that are unchangeable. And that is where the problem really arises. You have to know where to put in change and where to try to change and when not to try to change. And that is such a crucial importance, crucial difference between those two. So look at yourself, first of all. I mean, if there's anything you can change in the world, it must be you, right? You're closest to yourself. You're in charge of yourself to some extent. That is where change can happen. Far too often, people look at other people. You know, when you get upset with somebody, you're looking at the other person instead of looking at yourself. And that is the problem. So we're trying always to often we try to change in the wrong place. And that is often where it goes wrong. So certainly, try to change, but know where to look for that change. Did you still want to ask something here? Or,
make you more calm than when you eat some other type of meal with animals.
Okay. Whether eating vegetarian food makes you more calm and peaceful than eating meat. It depends. I would say it depends on your personality, I would say. I would say that if you are somebody who gets very upset by thinking about the killing of animals and you think that, you know, even the thought of eating meat makes you very upset, then yes, be a vegetarian, because in that case, it will be painful for you to eat meat. But if you are somebody who, you know, who doesn't think that's such a big deal, then I think eating meat is acceptable. I think the important point from a Buddhist point of view is that the Buddha didn't actually lay down a rule either for lay people or for monastics that meat eating is wrong. So because he didn't do that, you know, it's not an issue which is important enough for him to lay down a rule. Whether there are ethical issues involved with meat eating, it's impossible to answer that with any absolute yes or no. But if there is, the issues are so small and so minor, it doesn't actually affect your ability to be a kind and good-hearted person. So look at yourself. What works for you? And this is what I recommend people. If you really feel strongly about vegetarianism, about animals, go for it. Be vegetarian. If you feel it's not such a big issue, then it is acceptable to eat meat within certain bounds, as long as you don't go around killing animals or worse.
I asked this question 2 weeks ago of Angie Monsfield, who did the Dharma talk. She wouldn't give me an answer because she was a public servant. We were smack in the midst of an election last week, and I asked her how should a Buddhist approach how should a Buddhist approach an election? I mean, so the election is over now, but 5 years later it's going to come back. So I want to ask you now. You're not partisan, you're not a public servant, so you can answer this question. How should we, a Buddhist, approach an election when we go to the ballot box?
Okay. Well, I think that from a Buddhist point of view, you just have to, you know, just use the standard Buddhist principles, you know. What is going to give most benefit to people? What is going to give most benefit to society? How are we going to find harmony? How are we going to be kind to each other? How can we do things for each other in a good way? And ask yourself which candidate you think is most likely to give benefits to yourself, to Singapore, to the people of Singapore, in a good, harmonious, kind way. And that is probably how you should approach it. That's how I would approach an election in my if I ever voted, which I don't. As a monk, I don't vote. But I would ask myself, you know, how can we be more kind and good as a society? And I would look at the candidates. Sometimes you find that there are some candidates that have more integrity than others, some people who trust more than others. That is also important, that you feel a sense of trust, you feel the integrity, that the person is doing the right thing here. Something like that. Yeah.
Shall we give Tribam to the Ajahn for giving the talk?